This is the Amp Hour Podcast, released June 14th, 2020, episode 496, Drab Olive.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
You had to go and start, didn't you? You had to ask, which is more important?
Oh, the tweet.
Which is the more important skill in, was it engineering in general or was it electronics?
Yeah, it was engineering.
Engineering in general. Which is the more important skill, folks? Chris's two options are intelligence or determination. That's
you know,
all you
some
gave
of this,
us.
Dave, is meant to be, it was meant to be provocative. Actually, so that there is a story behind it.
So you were trolling?
No. Well, no, there's a story. So I
right. Okay. There's always context.
Yeah. I was asking about, because it was for my nephews and we were talking, so I was talking with my mom, you know, she's their grandmother, the kid's grandmother. And we were just talking about like the role of, you know, like those studies that say you shouldn't tell a kid they're so smart. You should tell them that they try hard. They tried hard. Have you heard about that research?
Not really. No.
Okay. I don't have any references to this because I didn't, Dave popped this on me. I didn't know what he was going to say.
Right. Okay. I did. Sorry.
Yeah. But yeah, there are studies out there that, you know, basically say it becomes an identity thing of like, oh, I'm so smart. And that it's not that it's an innate being thing. Like that
I am
a smart person. So that when they, so then if you fail, I felt this myself. Like if you fail, then you feel like, oh, I am a dumb person.
Mm-hmm.
The better message is usually more along the lines of, you know, you didn't put in the time or you didn't try that hard on this, this test or whatever, you know, whatever the outcome was. And so there's some research around like encouraging kids through doing that. And so that was really the genesis of that question. And, you know, it was provocative and, you know, people over the internet did or did not like that. And I fall on the, you know, like everyone's like, why not both? And of course, both, you know,
it's more like
if you have both, which one is more important? And I think persistence is more important, assuming you have both.
So. Yes, but of course, you've got to have both. You can't just have, because my response to that was that
persistence alone is not it. Yeah.
Use the word determination. So,
sorry. Oh, well, let's be official here.
Determination.
Yeah,
I think it was determination. Anyway.
It was,
right. So I went, if you just have determination, that leads to U-beam and solar roadways. Right.
Yeah, I think that's true. And
because you didn't have the intelligence to realize what you were doing or the path you were going on was just dumb. You should, you know, like think about it. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not very practical. Right.
You dug this out of a while ago. I forget when it was, but there was someone who was talking about, there was like a really good analogy of like the determinations, like the gas in the car and intelligence is actually knowing where to drive it or something along those lines.
Right.
Like,
okay.
That
kind of
thing. And it's important, right? And I think it's also comes down to like, you know, you could say intelligence versus, you know, earned wisdom, right? And like innate intelligence is, you know, I always think about like, you know, IQ and stuff like that. And like,
of course,
that alone doesn't, I mean, it'll get, you know, you're going to be bright, you're going to respond well, you might do well on testing, but does that mean that you're going to be as good at troubleshooting something on the bench where you really need to stick with it? Like that's when I think the determination really kind of kicks in.
Oh, of course.
But in the other direction, like you said, if you just stick with one thing, you just bang your head against the wall until you break through. It's like sometimes, you know,
sometimes you needed to walk around the wall. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
you should have
exactly,
just walked around, you know.
Yeah.
So
hence the provocative nature of the question.
The question, and yes, okay. I had to bring it because it is interesting, you know, who are the most, well, in engineering, right? In like, you know, science and physics, right? Intelligence is probably, you know, maybe like in pure research, for example, right? It might be intelligence that's, you know, the majority decider. Whereas in applied difference between theoretical physics might be mostly intelligence, but applied physics, for example, might be, you know, a more combination of both. You've got to have the intelligence, but also you've got to have the determination to follow through on the practical, you know, thing and not give up every time the result doesn't go your way, you know, and things like
that. Sure. I think some of it is like, I am not innately intelligent, but I like to think I'm determined in certain ways. So yeah,
right.
I favor determination. You know?
Yes. Well, I know. So what I was getting to was that engineering, right? When you have, you know, theoretical science, then you have practical science, and engineering is an applied science, right? You have to apply it. Engineering, you know, you have to solve a problem. You have to build something. That's engineering. And engineering's not just coming up with a good idea. That is not engineering. Engineering's making it happen. So, one of the groups, you know, engineers make it happen was their slogan, you know. I think it was Engineers Australia, maybe. I don't know. That's possibly where I got it from. Yeah, anyway.
It was like a television campaign or something, or what?
It was like an online, you know, media blitz kind of thing. Yeah, engineers make it happen. And that's really what it is. So if you don't have any determination whatsoever, you're screwed, right? You're really not going to be able to be an effective engineer. So, you know, you might make a good engineering manager, perhaps. I don't know.
I don't know what makes a good engineering manager. I think it's, tolerance for pain.
Well, we famously, I mentioned tolerance for pain. I famously mentioned this many times before, and this will segue into another thing we've got on our Reddit list, by the way. There's, you know, what, 5 universities here in Sydney that do engineering, right? And one of them, which is like our most prestigious, you know, oldest sandstone building university here, which is the University of Sydney, right? They have a big engineering course. Right, it's like, you know, 1,000 people or something. Sure. You know, 1,000 students or whatever.
Flagship,
you know,
university of the.
It's a flagship. You know, it's world renowned. You know, blah blah, and they've got a huge engineering program. But I don't believe, not once in my entire career have I ever met, or interviewed, or seen a resume of an engineer from the University of Sydney. They just I don't know where all these engineers go. They all come from.
I bet I do. Nope, I know where to go.
Okay, you
know,
tell me.
This is the thing. So for a long time, I didn't meet many like MIT engineers. I'm always like, where are they all going? And you know what the answer is, at least in the States, is I've met them since. But like I had the chance to go to MIT job fair when I was at Keithley. And it was very, very interesting because like seeing like who recruits
there. Yes, you've mentioned this before, I think. Yeah.
There were a ton of financial institutions there. And so they got locked up as quants, and they made a buttload of money, of course. You know, like, and I would have made the same decision probably. And we've definitely talked about that before. But I'm sure that, maybe they're just getting, you know, locked away into like really, you know, high-end jobs that you just don't need them, you know?
Yep. Please explain quants, for though that's a short shorthand term.
Yeah, what
term.
Does it stand
please
for?
Explain that.
It's like financial.
It's a quantitative analysis person, like somebody, you know, some like uber smart geek who runs the numbers, basically.
Yeah, or like creates algorithms for
and makes algorithms for stock trading and stuff like that. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So what's the financial equivalent? The insurance equivalent and...
Actuarial?
Actuary. Yep.
Yeah.
It's one of those uber smart math kids, you know.
Tables and stuff, right?
Is it? Oh, I don't know. I don't know about these. Yeah, but anyway, similar kind of thing. So, yeah, that's where they all must end up because it's just, I swear, I've never met one.
Or they just, you know, like, I'm sure they're out there. You know, I think that's the thing.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just, it's always fascinated me. Why?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of that stuff comes down to recruiting too. Like that is big, not big business, but it's definitely, it's a large, it's an important thing for both the school and for the companies where they're like, yeah, you know, I talked to some companies, they're like, yeah, we only go to MIT or we only go to these 5 schools and it's, you know,
and that's it.
Majority of the, you know, they're able to pay the salaries that are, you know, are tied to that kind of level of, you know, school and stuff. But that's where they get all their talent from. So,
yep. It's weird. Yeah. I just expect like at least a few to sort of like dribble out into the community, but no.
Yeah. I think the thing that's always interesting too, I'm sure we like we've been talking about, like I think we've talked about some of this stuff before and like how I got to go to MIT, but I went to like University of Michigan as well, which is, you know, good engineering school. And, you know, I went to a couple other, I went to Case, obviously, where it's my alma mater. And it's always amazing to me, like the effect of brand on students, like literally just anecdotally looking at like the line, the length of the line in front of companies, you know? And so you'd have I was with Keithley, right? Not a lot of
people lining up. Oh yeah. I've heard of an oscilloscope, you know?
Yeah. Well, right.
Or I've heard of them, but you know, I've used a multimeter. Yeah. Yeah. Keithley.
Right. Exactly. Maybe they had a multimeter, but maybe not with a, you know, source meter or whatever, but like, all that stuff. But then like you go like, and you see the Apple line and it's, you know, around the block and it's just like,
you know, SpaceX these days or Tesla. Oh, sure. Would have the line around the block, you know?
Right. And I think about, you know, young me and I'm like, same thing. Like I didn't know. And like, I feel like there's some kind of room for a resource here of just like, you know, it obviously it's on the student to go and, you know, research these things beforehand and blah, 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 all the things that career services do. But it would be a boon for our listeners that are younger to like, if you know of a company that's cool, that hires students and, you know, like, especially hiring out of school, it's tough, right? It's, you know, these days it's harder to get entry-level jobs than it used to be. So it does become come down to recruiting and stuff. But like understanding where these jobs are is important for that kind of, like where there's interesting problems that people that are accessible to cut rate talent like you and me, Dave.
Exactly. But it also comes down to the type of student as well. Like if you've just got regular Joe Blog student who, I got the SATs or the marks to get into engineering. So, I'll just go into engineering because I don't know, my mate went into engineering, whatever. My parents want me to do it, you know, and the true hobbyists who know what they want. Right, because they will know who Keithley is. They'll know who, you know, Texas Instruments is. They'll know who National Semi is or whoever.
Yeah, and then when they show up and they're like, I've used a TI part at the TI booth, they're like, oh, hello.
Hello, come on in.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen that happen, you know. Yeah. There was someone was posting, I'll have to see if I can find it. There was a student who posted on Reddit and someone had mentioned Contextual Electronics and that's the only reason I knew about the post. But it was basically like, I can't, you know, there's obviously, you know, we're still dealing with COVID stuff. A lot of internships are canceled. Jobs are you know, disappearing and stuff like that. And so this person was like asking about like, what should I do instead? And, you know, it was some good advice. It was, build projects and reach out and work on open source if you can. But mostly build stuff yourself so that you can, when you do, you know, if you're not going to do an internship, build your own internship.
Yeah, do it yourself.
And especially because a lot of people, at least in the U.S., are not traveling that much. It's like, use the time to, if you can, try and use the time to build something out and show it off later, like we always talk about on here. So,
yeah, totally. So that brings us, that segues nicely.
Does it?
Okay. Into, a news article that I put on the Reddit, got a few thumbs up. And so, many of the, I'd say probably most of the universities here in Australia, they could lose $16 billion.
Oh, yeah.
Because international students are locked out by the coronavirus. Of course, our borders are locked, you know, you can't come in. And that's $16 billion here in Australia. That's not Yankee bucks, right? That's, you know, 16. So $16 billion is a lot of money here in Australia, right?
It's a lot of money everywhere, actually, Dave.
Well, pretty much. But these universities, of course, I it's probably similar in the US, but probably not to the same extent as it is here in Australia, is the Australian universities have built their entire, you know, like physically built their universities, built all these fantastic whiz-bang new buildings and everything else on the backs of, like, there's been massive growth in the last 20 years of the universities here in Australia.
And it's all based
on the back of full fee-paying international students. And most of them are from China. Like, the majority of them are Chinese students. We've got over 400. Our entire country has a population of 25 million, right? We have over 400,000 international students, right?
Yeah.
That's a massive percentage of our – that's a huge percentage of our population just in foreign students, and they're all full fee paying.
Well, that's the exact same thing here. Yeah, that is, there is, yeah, it's all full fee. And, you know, I know people that work in international offices and stuff, and it's a huge part of university businesses, and universities themselves are huge businesses as well.
Oh, of course, yeah, they're massive. But, you know, they get funding, and, you know, that's what, if you want to be a professor or a lecturer at a university, half your time is going to be spent, you know, trying to win grants and stuff like that, you know, trying to win grant money. So it's, you know, it's a huge thing.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. Is that tied to the international thing though?
Oh, no. I'm just saying in general, you know, like.
Oh yeah. That's a big, if you have a research focus for sure. Yeah.
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 Half your time is spent finding money, let alone, and the other half is, you know, working on stuff. So yeah, be prepared for that. I've heard that from many
people. Yeah. One of my buddies is a researcher and, a professor. And he said him and a bunch of other professors were all on the same grant. It was a 1,000-page grant. I was like,
1,000-page grant.
1,000 pages.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. It's crazy.
Yeah. That's insane. Yeah. How long did it take? Yeah, it might have taken them 6 months of work to actually write that grant so that they can get that money, so that they can spend the next 6 months working on it. And then they've got to go through the whole process again.
It's another Ferris wheel to step onto. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So the university thing is really interesting. Yeah. So my friend Sophie had sent me Scott Galloway is someone who's been writing about universities and about, like, the coming death of a lot of universities, basically.
I've heard the name. Does he write a blog somewhere or?
Yeah, so he's an NYU professor in the business school there.
Yeah.
And he also has a podcast, which is pretty good.
That's probably where I've heard him from.
Yeah. He's real, real sharp voice and very strong opinions. and basically what his argument is, like, look, the high-end universities are, they're trophies, right? So you get a degree from a high-end university, like MIT or Stanford or whatever.
You're
set, of course, but, like, basically they're so expensive and, like, they're so exclusive that it's almost not the reality for a lot of people out there. And then it was basically, though, that, like, so much money, like you're talking about with the Australian universities, so much money is propping up a ton of schools that are out there that a lot of the, you know, second and third tier schools just aren't going to make it. And like, thinking through the implications of that, especially with the U.S., debt, you know, student debt stuff. I'm sure some of our listeners have student debt.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's just, like, such a huge, I'm going to not do it justice, of course. So I do recommend people go and read some of his stuff.
It's a massive problem. It's one of your biggest problems there, apart from health and social security welfare benefits, right? Yeah. It's like the third biggest.
It's one of the largest. Yeah. One of the largest debt sources. Past, like, mortgage. I think it may have outstripped mortgages and credit card debt.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it might have. It's huge. Yeah, I read the number a couple of months back and it was like, oh, wow, you know.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it.
So Scott writes about all this stuff and just how a lot of third tier schools aren't going to make it. And yeah, it's pretty crazy to think about. Like,
what is the repercussion of them not, they'll shut down.
Like, completely shut down. Yeah. He said, he said that the median, I forget the number. I think it was like the median endowment of the 4,500 schools that are out there. So, like, endowment being like the chunk of money they use to fund the rest of the school was something like, it was less than $10 million. So basically $7 million or something like that. Not enough to pay anything. Yeah. You'd either spend it or, you know, but basically that means they're completely dependent upon people showing up.
That's a really small school. That's,
yeah, well, and it's not. They weren't really small schools. Wow. So it was like basically the cash flow at these schools is just going to be trash. So I'm really interested. Obviously, you know, I have weird views on education, but I don't think that, you know, as much as I talk about contextual electronics as like an educational thing, I don't actually understand what the world looks like without a lot of the universities that are out there. And so, like, I'm very interested to see where it all goes, kind of morbid curiosity kind of way. I feel for everyone who's part of it, though. It's like, you know, yeah, there's just a lot of shit going on right now. So
yeah.
So I do recommend people listen to the podcast, and he has a newsletter too. So
cool, have to check it out. There is there's no talk here of universities going under, like, because we don't have that many. Like, you know, we aren't populous as the US. So anyway, there's no talk of them going under, but there's talk that look, because apparently like half the international students come in or start their course at the second half of the year, right? And we're bang, we're right on the second half of the year here, and we're not letting anyone in the country for, you know, obvious reasons, right? So...
That
then not only delays it by 6 months, but then apparently they're talking about it actually has flow-on effects for several years. So just stopping 6 months mm-hmm. of people coming in now has like 3-year flow-on effects. So yeah,
sure. Think about like research labs that are like, you know, expecting people to be like part of the, you know, the machine that is grad students and postdocs and everything else. Yeah, it's just crazy.
And it's not just the stopping of full fee paying students, not just the sudden drop to zero of full fee paying international students, although there's still some that are here, you know, the ones that are here already are going to keep going. But yeah, there's massive numbers, like hundreds of thousands who can't get here. And so it's not just that, but on top of that, then there's the whole COVID economy, you know, slowdown thing. Right. So therefore, you know, like big companies are going to invest less, you know, governments might invest less and things like that in, you know, things like pure research and, you know, other things. So, yeah, there's just going to be cutbacks there. So it's a double whammy. So,
yeah,
it's not looking good, please. If you're at a uni, you know, if you're in the know at these unis here in Australia or in the US or in your country, please let us know in the comments.
Yeah.
Down below, is it, you know, is there talk, like, are people, you know, really scared witless that, you know, their department or their project or their funding's gonna vanish?
Well, hopefully not.
Yeah, it's a big deal, but I think it is going to happen. Like, I don't think there's any way out of it. Things are going to have to, you know, some things are going to have to shut down. Hopefully not in entire schools, you know, because imagine if you were halfway through. You know, imagine if you're halfway through your course and then your universe, we just shut down. What the hell happens then, you know?
Right.
And you spend all that money. Maybe you could transfer, perhaps. How is it over there? Do you guys have like a national framework? We've kind of got like a national framework here where if you're at one school, you can actually transfer to a different school because they're all on the same framework. No?
That is definitely not the case here. Yeah, no, I've had some friends who tried to transfer, and it's like you have to cross the courses, and you have to like, you know, prove that it's this, because you think about it from a financial perspective, like you're going to a new school. The new school doesn't want to be like, oh yeah, don't take any classes here. Just get the name on the degree. You know, it's like, no, that's not, I mean, they're
right.
They're a business, you know, like a lot of them are private schools and like they're a business and okay, fine. Right. It's up to them. But like, yeah, there's no, I think the state schools are probably more likely to accept other
have
state schools
like that, right? Okay.
Yeah, right. But it is, but it's like interstate system as well too, so like, you know, the equivalent of like,
right,
you know, New South Wales versus like Queensland or something,
yeah. Right,
so
gotcha.
There's nothing I as far as I know, there's nothing national, but I, you know, I'm not that much in the know, so
okay, interesting.
Your mileage may vary.
Yeah. But there are national, once you get your degree though, I've done a video on this, which is, you know, how you can go overseas and then your degree, if it's under the Washington Accord or it's under the Sydney Accord, these are different national accord. These are different global accord things, and like most universities sign up to these accords. And so if you've got your degree from one university in the US, you can come to Australia and it's officially recognized by the Institute here because it's under the Washington Accord or something, you know. So that's
It's a weird business.
Yeah.
You know, like I wish there was a way to just prove that you actually knew the content instead of just, you know, it's so hard to like do that. It's like, we could have a test or we could do, you know, like... But at the end of the day, like I was literally, you know, I had a video thing over the weekend. I had to reset up my lab and I saw my college degree and I'm actually staring at it right now. And it says, the trustees have admitted Christopher John Gammel to the degree of Bachelor of Science. Engineering. Like, who the hell is a trustee? Like, I don't care about them. You know, like literally it's like this, like, you know, you've been inducted into this.
Secret society.
I mean, like, I get it, but honestly, the name of the top's all I care about here, folks.
Right. Well, we've mentioned this before. It's like once you graduate, you quickly realize, maybe, you know, it's going to vary from country to country, but certainly here in Australia, which course you did in which university, that goes to the very bottom of your resume. Nobody cares. It's like nobody cares. It's like, can you do the job? They will test. They'll ask you questions. They'll get the vibe. Show me projects you've worked on. You know, what other companies have you worked for? It quickly becomes totally irrelevant.
And it's I would say, having looked at a lot of resumes as well, like even though it's somewhat transparent, I think that, so say a young person is listening, like they're in college, they're like, oh man, I'm leaving school, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know, and or just that person who was taking advice online, right? They're struggling, they want to build something. I would say it's actually better to build a thing for yourself. Maybe you're going to do that anyways, right? You're going to build a thing to yourself. I think it's better to make up a name for your company and then say you're building it for your company and then list it under work experience. Now, it can be...
You could. And there's nothing... And you wouldn't be lying. So
I think you should be transparent about it. It's like, no, that's my company. I was building it for me or you know for this purpose or whatever it was. You should be very transparent about it. Maybe even make your company be, you know, your name .inc or not Inc. That's actually illegal. But like, you know, right. your name industries or something, you know, Chris Gamble Industries or something like that. And like, so, but be very transparent about that, but show it as work experience because it is.
Absolutely.
You know, assuming you're regulated about it. And I just think that that's better than being like, oh, and I built, you know, it's not a hobby. It's like a thing that you're building because you should be building
and
a thing.
And even then, like sell five of them and then, it literally is a commercial product.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It is interesting. Like those small things that like push you over the edge. And it's like, oh, actually I am a business. Okay. Yeah.
just because you sold five of them on freaking Tindy or somewhere, right?
Yeah, that's great.
It doesn't matter. It's a commercial product.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, people are making a living on there too. So like, it's not
Of course. No.
You know, it's more of a question of scale at that point, but yeah, I think it's, you know, you're building a thing.
Yep.
Let me tell you about a thing I'm building, Dave.
Please.
And how I was a bit put off today. So I've been, you know, this is actually the thing I've talked about on the show before. I'm building a thing for Contextual Electronics and it's got an NRF52840. And wouldn't you know it, there has been it's not a bugger, it's like a disclosure. I guess it's a disclosure, but basically someone announced recently that they can completely bypass all firmware protection on the NRF52840.
Nice. Like, oh, man. Does this actually impact you though?
Not really. Well, that's a good question, right? So, you know, this is a, you know, it's a board I'm building for the course and for myself and as a development platform. And I think at a certain point, yes, of course it does, right? I'm designing a thing that it could go out in the world. It's, you know, if it's a development platform, that means that I have to redevelop it later. But like, it comes down to like, what is the, if it's a first spin, it's a first spin, right? I'm trying to get something out anyway, so I'm just going to keep going. But, you know, it's like the, when do you make that decision? Do you throw away all the work you've done? Or do you keep going with it and then you say, well, I'm going to change it later. You know, I'm going to...
Well, if it's a product critical feature, then obviously you have to take some action. If it's not, you go, meh, so what? You know, like if it's just like a dev board or something, it's like, well, doesn't matter, right? It's like, yes, you have to make people aware who are you going to use this dev board that, yes, this silicon has this, you know, issue.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if it's a security forward application where it's like, oh, well, I need this to be a secure product, that's probably not the right dev board for you. It's probably not the right part for
you. Oh, yes. If you're using that part for like a some sort of crypto hardware wallet,
exactly.
You know, it's you're going to come a gutter. So. Right.
But you might not want to put Bluetooth on it in the first place then.
Right, yeah, of course. what is the mechanism? Is it like a side channel? Is it a power rail side channel attack?
Yeah, right, side channel. Yeah.
Side channel.
And so, you know, I was talking to Colin O'Flynn actually the other day. Yep. And
who has developed the...
he's been on the show before. And he does the Chip Whisperer and the
Chip Whisperer,
Chip Shouter and stuff like that.
Yep.
I still don't quite understand how it works, to be completely honest. I kind
of
get it.
Yeah.
It's...
It allows you to do methodical side channel harvest. So power, you can, you know, monitor the power and going in and out and you can, you know, modulate things and you can...
Yeah, and I think there's some fuzzing here as well. But basically, at the end of the day, what happens is you can then go and dump all you get basically you get debugger control on this chip using these methods that
and then bam, once you've got debugger control, you've got you can dump out all the code.
You could do more than just dump it though, I think, if you have debugger.
Oh, really?
So
Okay. Oh, yeah, no, of course. Well, a debugger is a debugger. You can change registers on the fly. You can, you know, do all that sort of jazz. So,
So, yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting from a, well, I mean, it's not like, I'm not the problem here, right? This is like, you know, the NRF52840 is like, it's out in the world, man. There are a lot of products out there. This is not a small part. So that's a much
how did you
deal.
Find this? How did you, did somebody tweet it to you? Oh, right. Hacking News. Right. Okay. Yep. And you went, I'm using that. Oops.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's just an interesting, you know, there's always the voyeurness of like seeing an interesting hack, right? That's always interesting.
Yeah.
But it just happened to be the chip that I was using. Yeah. So it's not like I got like an email from.
But it's like shoulder shrug these days. It's, oh, yeah, there's another chip that you can bypass with side channel attack. It's like if that thing really matters for your product, you're going to spend a month doing your research on which is the best device to choose. You know, it's like and for reasons, you know, it might have physical hardware protection in there that prevents side channel attack. It's got physical hardware protection in there over the die that actually prevents decapping and then laser, you know, reading out of the ROM contents and, you know, all that sort of jazz. So,
yeah,
it's like if you wanted an ultra secure device, you probably wouldn't be using something with, as you said,
with a security in the name or something like that.
Bluetooth interface. Yeah. It's, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
No, there are specific devices on the market.
I just thought it was interesting because I am, you know, mid-design. Like, I don't think...
Yep.
I don't know. Have you ever had that where you had like a design and it like went obsolete or anything like that too? Like I've just never had. I've had actually one thing where the connector went obsolete.
I haven't worked on consumer-y enough products for it to be a problem. Let's put it that way.
So like
we have gone into production for knowing that part is obsolete. Right. And we couldn't be bothered changing it because we're only going to manufacture 100 of these things, 1,000. You know, like
you buy a tray or two and you're good to go, you're saying.
And you're good to go. You're good to go. Because like we're in that business. We would have a 5-year contract for a project to supply the military or some other company, right? Man. And then you just buy the parts up front. Bingo. I've got my entire, you're contracted to produce 10,000 of these widgets. You buy 10,000 of the chips and you're sweet. You know, it's like who cares if it went obsolete? Doesn't matter.
Buy insurance.
You'll actually cover that down the road. Well, you can deal with that down the road. And we've discussed, component obsolescence, and you've done that in your job, haven't you? Component obsolescence engineer.
Yep.
You know. So you would deal with that down the road. You would, often there'd be like a pin compatible part. You'd drop it in and you'd recompile or something, or you know, some other thing. At worst case, you would have to relay out your board. If you didn't want to touch the board, you wanted to modify existing products, you would do a mod board. I've done videos on how to do mod boards and things like that.
Relatively recent, right? That was like a flex PCB or something?
Wasn't. That was a flex PCB one, but I've done other videos as well on actual mod boards, of making mod boards, which if you don't know...
I've done that before,
if those who don't know what a mod board is, I'll quickly go over it. It's where you've got an existing product, you know, you've shipped, you know, or you've already got, you know, 10,000 blank boards, right? And they're really expensive boards. They're like, you know, 10 layer and they cost, you know, $100 a board or something. And they're giant things. And you don't want to, right? You've already made the investment in those boards. You don't want to re-spin them, right? Because it's really expensive. It's going to come as a shock to people, but not everyone makes little Arduino sized, you know, 4-layer boards that cost, you know, a couple of bucks, right?
I mean, you're making a 4-layer board for an Arduino, Dave. Come on, don't be too fancy here.
Oh, too fancy, right? Yeah. No, you know, some boards cost hundreds or $1,000 a pop, right? For a one-off blank board, right? Because they're 16 layers and they've got micro vias and they're, you know,
Just the amount of time and the process that was put into...
And they're physically large.
Slapping that thing together, you know?
Like, exactly. And they, you know, they got so many, you know, and they got Rogers, you know, controlled impedance material and they got, you know, everything else, right? Really expensive stuff. So you don't want to re-spin that. You can't re-spin those boards. You can't dump them.
Well, you can.
So you need... Just... Well, you can, but it's expensive, right? It's just, no. Yeah. So you decide, no, it's cheaper. You know, you've got 1,000 of these things. It's cheaper to make a little adapter, Modboard's a little adapter board that basically goes over the existing footprint. It depends on the physical implementation of the thing you're trying to, say you've got a quad flat pack chip or something, right, that you want to actually replace, then you would get a board that actually fits that footprint. So that, and then it would have a half moon castellated edges on the side of the board, right? That would actually line up with the pads, and then you'd put another chip on top of that, for example, and that's a mod board where it'll solder in. You might have to hand solder it, for example, but hey, you know.
But you're only making 100 or 10,
doesn't matter, right? So then you solder that board in to actually physically replace the chip that you want to do. And then you can get more fancy using flex circuits. If you need to connect this point of the circuit over here to somewhere over the board, you can make this big flex, you know, overlay kind of thing that joins up the two things, so you don't have to do mod wires and stuff like that. It's just neater. But anyway, that's a thing you'll often have to do in the engineering world, is a mod board. Very common. So yeah.
And very annoying. Very annoying.
Oh no, I actually enjoy, oh, you want me to do a mod? Oh, I've got to do a mod board. It's really nice to be able to figure out how to actually do it nicely. You know, I actually enjoy the process. Call me a, you know, sick puppy, but I actually rather enjoy it. Yay. I got to build a mod board rather than just relay. I don't want to rip up the board. I'd rather have the engineering challenge of making a mod board. I really enjoy it.
All right. Well,
yes, I'm weird. Sue me.
You do you, buddy. You do you.
Anyway, that's that. What else did we want to get on? Oh, yeah. I retweeted this one because this is an Artifruit post, and this is interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Type C USB, because you know USB is always bloody changing, isn't it? And you know, once
I do wonder it's... past this, what
the next
type
USB?
C. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, USB Type C. USB Type C is a you know how it's got all these new power delivery stuff. You know, it's got these two lines in there. It's got the CC line, CC1 and CC2 lines. There are extra lines on the USB connector that allow you, you know, I2C type lines that allow you to actually communicate between the you know the host and the device how much power you need. So if you plug in a power, you know, if you plug in one of those portable battery packs and you want to fast charge it, right, it needs to send data to the charger to say, hey, I'm a smart device, I can handle, please
give me
20
all you got.
Volts at 5 amps, yeah. Please give me 100 watts, right?
Yeah.
And which I think is close to the maximum for USB-C.
That is the max.
Close enough. Yeah, 5 volts, and so you can change the voltage. So USB-C is capable of the power delivery standard is capable of. It's not just 5 volts; it's capable of going up to other voltages, right? And current. So you've got to negotiate that smartly. And some products, like I said, a USB power bank or something, right, or some other thing that you just want the power. That's it. You're using the USB-C connector just for the power. That's it. You don't need to send data. Yep, yeah. Give me the juice. But you still need to negotiate that. So rather than using a pain in the ass a regular USB-C connector that has all how many pins on a regular USB-C connector and how tiny a pitch are they? They're just a pain.
20 plus, I think. Yeah, yeah. 24 pins, yep.
Absolute nightmare, right? Really mongrel parts, you know. Pain in the ass thing of the week, right? Pain in the ass component of the week. Is that an acronym? Anyway, so rather than do that, CUI, who's a connector manufacturer, they've just released one, which is the, well, for those playing along at home, the UJC HP3 SMT. Mm-hmm. It's the connector of the week, and it only has the power pins and the two CC lines. I think it's got 6 pins and a 1 millimeter ping pitch. Beauty.
Yeah.
Geez, one millimeter. Geez, you could, you know, drive a truck through one millimeter. Unbelievable. So nice. It's just a connector dedicated to just that. So I think it's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than some of these other connectors you posted about on Twitter. What about these other?
Yes, I forgot about those. Yep. Yeah. They're yes, I did put those on the Reddit, didn't I?
Yeah. This orthogonal, advanced orthogonal interconnects and similar out of this world military style connectors.
That one actually got almost the most thumbs up, I think. Yes, people were, so let's talk about that. People wanted to talk about these connectors. Phone FOON on Twitter posted these, so I retweeted those. And advanced orthogonal interconnect is a pin grid array right angle
adapter.
I've
never seen anything like this. So
oh, you haven't? Oh yeah, no, these are,
it's kind of hard to explain, but what is this even for? So it looks like
What it's for is for if you've got your existing, you're designing your product and it's got this advanced processor on it, right? Which is a big pin grid array thing, not this BGA rubbish, right? Like it looks like a pin grid array. So it's like, you know, 50
you actually plug, like the old Motorola connectors you're talking about, like the ones where the pins are on the edges and stuff like that, and they plug into like a huge socket or something.
No way. Like the old school 486 processors that they actually came with right? So those, right? So if you've designed your board, you've laid out your board, and then you want to troubleshoot it, this is like advanced, you know, high-end tools. You know, you want to put your logic analyzer on there, your debugger and all that sort of stuff for this advanced processor or FPGA or something, right? And you want to probe it in real time, then you get one of these adapters, you either plug it in or solder it into your board, and then it brings out all the pins at right angles via controlled impedance traces, right? And you know, so it's all, these things probably, you know, these things are really expensive. Right?
Oh,
I don't know
it,
how much this one would cost, but you know, you can spend hundreds of dollars, start at hundreds of dollars for one of these adapters, orthogonal interconnects, sorry. And yeah, they just bring out all the pins so that you can plug your chip into the outside and then you can probe, you know, you get access to probey pins. Although this one's a bit weird. It's got like large copper internal things in some triangular wedge shape thing. So it's really...
Yeah.
This one's a bit bizarre, but the general concept is you're breaking out. It's basically a breakout board.
Yeah, okay. So it's not actually like a practice, and like people, like we said, it's tough to say it in words, obviously. We'll have links to Foon's Twitter account and stuff like that.
Although technically this one, I think it is physically a connector. I think it is a connector. It's a right angle connector, effectively.
Mm.
I think it is. Okay. That's what those large copper, you've got to see the photo, those large copper flat pads in the middle, in the X shape in the middle are. I think they're large power pins. Mm. And then all the others on the other pins on the outside are, you know, like just regular pins, right? Mind you, they're controlled impedance because it looks like controlled impedance traces. I can see that they've got the little squiggles in there,
squiggles,
so they're matching the length, right? They're matching the length of the traces there. So, So it's high speed, obviously. But so I got sidetracked there. This one's probably some sort of weird ass right angle PCB connector, I think, rather than a breakout, which was what I was talking about. But I've seen these identical things.
The whole
breakouts.
Thread is just like, it's weird, you know, mechanicalness and probably military connectors and stuff.
Yeah, this was the industry I was in.
Right. I was going to ask about that.
Right.
Yeah.
We needed, right? The example, this one that has all these Ethernets, got 2, 4, 6, 8 Ethernet pairs in the one military connector. You can tell it's like military type because they all have the same drab or olive. I think it's officially called drab olive or semi-officially called drab olive finish. Like, you know, actual color. It's a similar, you know.
Yeah, it's that military fatigue style. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of thing. If you've ever seen the military stuff, they're all the same drab orange olive color. Anyway, so rather than, you know, you could have just used Ethernet connectors. You could have just used 8 regular Ethernet interconnects. But then, A, you've got 8 separate cables. Right, so you've got to plug them in, and you can plug them in the wrong way. This is designed for like aircraft and tanks and vehicles and other industrial machinery where you have to disconnect stuff for maintenance and testing and replacement and things like that and plug them back together and get the plane or whatever back in the sky, right? But you don't want to have run any risk of plugging the wrong thing in to the wrong place when you reconnect it back in. Right, it's not just the robust nature of these military connectors. It's also for the fact that you can't goof it up.
Right. So, you know, I was just thinking as I'm like scrolling down this list, and I'm like thinking, you know, these connectors are terrible to look at, but you know what? You should see them.
Oh, they're gorgeous. What do you mean?
No, you should see the friggin' cable diagram for these things. You know, just like the amount of some of these things have hundreds of pins attached to them. And it's like, you gotta have a drawing for each and every pin, you know, like, yeah, okay, Ethernet, yeah, you get it, it's like a bunch of pairs, but like, you know, when it's 100 individual pins, then they gotta go somewhere.
Dude, try soldering connectors like this. I've spent countless hundreds of hours soldering connectors like these, and when you're, it'd take you an hour or 2 hours to terminate one of these connectors. Right.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah.
And hours to terminate. And then just before you put in the last one, you realize, oh, I'm using the wrong diagram. No, well, yeah, A, you forgot the heat shrink. Or B, you're using the mirrored diagram. You're using the front face diagram instead of the rear face diagram. Oh, my God. Like, this happens so many times in our business. We had to come up with.
Why
like
do we even
color.
Have this? Why is this? Why is the obvious? Why is the other drawing even a thing?
We would have to have like large color coded fonts in like 200 point font on there. You know, permanent marker saying back side diagram. You know, like it had to be in your face. Otherwise, you'd accidentally, if it was just down in the info box in the bottom corner, right, you'd get the wrong one.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And then you waste hours just soldering in them all mirror image. And then you've got to desolder them all and you've got to start again. You have no idea how many times this happened. It's just,
right. Well,
oh my God.
Intelligence versus perseverance, Dave.
Perseverance. Sometimes you're just having a bad day and Murphy's going to get you.
Exactly. Exactly. Sometimes you're having a bad day and you know what? You screwed it up. You got to do it again. No amount of saying how smart you were allows you to just swap the connector around.
Exactly. No amount of, anyway. So these connectors are very common, these custom, you know, like we'd have ones with mixed twisted pairs. We'd have ones like that had twisted pairs, power, optical in the same connector, giant, like everything, all in the optical and mechanical and pins all mixed in the same connector.
How would that work? Would you have to like crimp the optical first or something? Or how would you actually?
You would terminate the opticals usually went in last. You'd terminate the others and then you'd leave room to slip in the opticals. But you had to, you had to polish the optical connectors and then you'd have to terminate the optical connectors and there's special machines to terminate those. And
would the termination like be built into the connector though? Or would it be like, and then like, or you do it externally and then plug it in?
You do it externally and then plug it in. So you would, and the connector would be physically designed so that when you plug it in, there's like a latching thing and it'd keep it at the right distance. And usually they're spring loaded. So when the optical things are spring loaded, so that when the two connectors join and you screw them together, they actually touch before it gets to the end stop. And then when you tighten it up, it applies a little bit of pressure to the two optical ferrules and then they line up, you know. Otherwise, you can't just rely on the fact that they're just going to mate, you know, like half a millimeter. Like, no, you want the springiness to. Anyway, companies like Amphenol, for example, they're one of the biggest in the industry. They have entire departments dedicated to designing these custom connectors for you. So you go to them and say, like, you know, they will make any connector you want to any specification. It's absolutely amazing what these companies can do. Right. And
technically, Dave, if you have enough money, a lot of companies will do whatever you want.
We'll do whatever you want. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Give us enough time and a good enough spec sheet. We'll try and build it for you. You know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
I guess
you can go to them and say, okay, I need 200 of these special connectors. Right.
Yes.
Which have 50 pins and optical and Ethernets and everything in there. Right. And all these in a high speed and all these, you know, because they've got all these different technologies that they can wham into the one connector, and they can, you can mix and match anything.
I'm just remembering back to like previous shows where you say, oh, we have to make everything custom. You know, you were talking about the micro supply. Yeah. Everything has to be custom. And I was thinking about these kind of exact conversations where someone says, we have to be custom. And then you start talking about 50 connectors at a time. It's just like, man, it's a sickness. It's like, it's...
Yeah. But no, you know, but sometimes you have some, legitimate reasons. Some have requirements.
So yeah, I get it, but
come on. So these companies, where you can go to them and say, I want 200 of these connectors, and they'll happily make it for you, and they'll charge you $500 per connector. You know, there's no problems.
At least.
At minimum, right?
Yeah.
But it solves, it solves a niche problem that you need, and you just pass that cost on to the customer. It's, when you're in that sort of industry where one product costs, $50,000, it doesn't matter that you use a $200 connector on it, right?
Right.
It makes if it does the job you need. And
right. Or if it's going to save, save water damage down the road or whatever.
Oh,
yeah. Sometimes you just got to have it.
Oh, waterproof connectors. There's an, because I was in the marine seismic business. Yes. Waterproof connectors on top of this, on top of this, we'd have waterproof as well. You know, it's absolutely double O-ring, by the way, they have to be greased up, by the way. If you don't grease up your O-rings, it's not waterproof.
You got to grease up your O-rings, folks.
Yep. You got to get the right pressure. There's all the mechanical engineers out there are salivating at the thought of actually designing an O-ring properly.
Yeah, everybody is a fan of this design until they have to spend 200 hours analyzing if any water has ingressed into anything in a submersion tank or whatever.
I also have a fascinating video that touches on this, Rodney Redwin from Simulator Solutions. I've done those 747 flight simulator videos. Yep. And he takes us through a 747 cockpit and shows us some of these custom connectors. And a lot of them, even though they're identical connectors, you can actually get them keyed differently. So that literally you can, even though they're the same connector, they're keyed. They're keyed around the outside. So you cannot plug in the wrong one into the wrong thing.
Which
is
good.
Pretty important in an aircraft if you're because these aircraft have to be checked and maintained and repaired they're on a regular basis. You can't just use the same connector for everything without keying. It's like, geez, no.
Well, you can at your own detriment, I think.
Custom connectors, I love custom connectors, they're great. Anyway, very exciting. I've a large part of my career has involved custom connectors. So, and testing them. When you get the connectors, then you'd have to design and build a jig, which, insertion jig. So that you can physically mate them and insert them. And the screw on ones are different. Sometimes you just have to got to do it by hand. Mm-hmm. So you got to do your 1,000. Insertions.
No strong forearms,
So anyway, great stuff. Mm. Love it.
Well, what else is on the list? Let's see. Alan, former guest of the show, Alan, did this was a really great video. I wish I would have had this before I bought my VNA.
And it's going to be a series. I think he's mentioned that it's going to be a series. So, yes.
Yeah, he's going to be doing a lot of basics. If he's listening, I kind of hope it's not because of me, but if it is, I probably could have used this. But the really cool thing about it, so the thing that I didn't quite understand, I understood kind of the basics of it, but I really like that he shows how a VNA works in theory. And basically he's passing a signal out. What a VNA is effectively is you're passing an AC signal out or, a sine wave effectively at different frequencies, and then you're seeing how it bounces back, just like reflections on, a PCB trace or any other, matched impedance type of thing. And that's what you're basically testing. And so he puts
that's because everything's a transmission line, folks.
That's right. Yeah. And so he shows how it actually reflects and then how the actual wave shows up on a scope then. So he's looking in the time domain, of course, but it's just really, really good. So
and then you have to get into ports. You've got to get into multi-ports and things like that. That's, and then you have to get into your S, you have to get into your S parameters and your, all sorts of other stuff, joyful stuff, which that's not my field.
Yeah, I'm trying to make it my field. It's been a challenge, I have to say.
Yeah.
I've really been. So I've been, like I mentioned 2 weeks ago, I've been, you know, working on mine, and Mr. Jeff Kaiser has been helping with some stuff. And what it really comes down to is just like, there's no way to know like the reference point of like what's good, you know, like, so especially because I'm a beginner and like, and you know, like you have a calibration kit and you have to like understand if it's right. And, and anything will show as it's being calibrated. Right. So you put these, you know, you put an open, you put a short, and you put a load on there, 50 ohm load. And then basically it, you know, calculates all these coefficients and it does all the math to make it look like a flat line when it's, you know, when it's open, and when it's on a Smith chart, it's like right in the middle, it's 50 ohms and everything looks great. But then like lately I've been like looking at it, I'm like, I put a cable on then, and it's like, oh, this cable is emitting RF energy somehow. It's like, nope, that's not right. That's not how that works. So yeah, it's just, you know, knowing, you know, kind of like these, it's not really mantras, but it's just like these kind of higher level ideas of what can and can't happen, you know, like on a Smith chart, right? You can't be outside a Smith chart or else you're usually emitting energy and stuff like that. And it's been very, very enlightening and frustrating together.
And that reminds me of speaking about VNAs and calibration and connectors, tie them all together. Oh.
Wow.
winner, chicken dinner. Is that, that reminds me of when I went to the Keysight Cal Lab, and I've done videos on this, and they were talking about, you know, when you're talking about like high calibrating, you know, high frequency RF stuff, right?
Yeah.
The torque on the connector matters, right? You have to use a torquing tool on these connectors, and if you don't get the right torque, your calibration is not valid because you're going to be out by a dB or two, you know, because you torqued it wrong. Right. When you're talking about a 10 gigahertz being a specialized, you know, SMA connector or something, right? Working at 10 gig on some scope or 20 gig.
No, don't do SMA for 10 gig. That's bad.
Oh, well, you know, right? Well, no.
Yeah, right. Whatever how about, so APC7, which I've learned is a connector, because that's when my VNA showed up and I'm like, what is this connector on the front? I don't know how to actually interface with this. It's a very, very,
and that's
why
you can buy $500 for a connector.
Right? Yeah, or a converter. Yeah, that's what I did.
For a converter, right? Because it's got the
APC 7 to 3.5 millimeter is the $500 worth of metal. It's a hell of an industry, Dave. Let me tell you,
$500 for a 50 ohm Terminator. You know, thank you very much. $1,000 for a 50 ohm Terminator, right? And you can literally ruin them if you don't torque them up properly. Mm-hmm. And these high end scopes, you know, if you're talking, you know, your 20 gig, your 50 gig, your 100 gig scopes, those connectors, if you abuse those, you've just screwed your scope, right?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm sure you could get a refurb for a couple thousand, you know, you could probably send it in for service.
So I've done videos on that if those want to know about the, you know, the intricacies of RF connectors and stuff like that. It's absolutely fascinating. Like most engineers probably would never care about that sort of, you would never know nor care about that sort of thing, you know, because you're working on your digitally Arduino-y, you know, Raspberry Pi
thing
widget,
that's less than 10 megahertz and you're happy, you know. I used to be there, Dave. I used to be less than a gigahertz. Those were the days.
No, I'm just not, RF's not my thing.
It's interesting. I mean, like, I would, if you're open, it's, you know, I think it's tough for you because, like, you know, you're often learning in public and that's tough because you have a big presence with that. And it's like, but it has been, it has been a re-education. It has been a humbling experience. Like, just like how many things I don't know about it. Like, and obviously there's a lot of people that like, this is their life and their job. And like, I really respect it. Like that kind of knowledge. Yeah. And that's why, you know, some RF consultants charge $400 an hour, of course.
Of course.
Like, but for them,
like,
you know?
Like there's no way I could go out and use a VNA without a refresher course like this. I just wouldn't be able to do it. You could give me a DSA. Like, I'm used to using a dynamic signal analyzer, which, you know, is like 20 kilohertz was high frequency, you know.
Oh, right. So that's like a network analyzer for like an audio circuit or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's totally, it's a similar sort of thing, you know.
And, it is. Yeah. We used to use that for control loops at Keithley, how it's proper through, you know, like if you got an oscillation or something. It's great.
So I could tell you all about coherence and, you know, signal coherence on DSAs and stuff like that. Mm. You know, that was my bread and butter. But
got it.
Put me in front of a VNA and go, well, okay, you know, measure this connector and transmission line. I'm going to go, oh, geez, no, I could bumble around and, you know, maybe get something up, but I really wouldn't know the intricacies of it. That's stuff that I just never been into.
Well, if you need someone to call, I can refer you. Yes, sir. Yep.
Anyway, this will be a great series. Yeah. V&A series.
So if you have questions like Dave and you want to ask us something, probably not about V&As, Dave, who can they call? Who can they?
Ghostbusters.
Who can they?
Jason Reitman.
No.
No, come on.
It's us, Dave.
All right. Yeah.
They can call us. So we are going to do a call-in show for the 500th episode of The Amp Hour. We're going to take some questions at least. We're probably going to talk about other stuff too.
Oh, yeah. But that is. Probably. Yep.
This is 496. We are racing towards it. So
yep.
Early July.
So we'll do that. So we still haven't decided what, probably like email. Like you can always email in your MP3 with your question. Say, hi, I'm such and such from such and such. If you want to, you don't have to identify yourself. You can just ask your question, you know.
Sure.
But it has to be in voice form.
It's a lot easier if we can mention, you know, at least a screen name, you know, like. And so, you know, Scope Lover 123 is called in about blah, blah, blah. Right. Yeah, I mean, like, yeah.
Got it. Ah, the interwebs. Yep.
Yeah.
It's great. So, yes, we'll try and do that. We have had a call-in show. We did try it, like, donkeys years ago, didn't we?
We did multiples. We did, like, four or five call-in shows.
Did we? Yeah. Oh, really? Okay, well.
Yeah. We stopped doing them because people stopped calling. Right. And so,
the novelty wore off.
Yeah, I think some of it's that. I think some people are, like, listen. So this is going to be a couple shows out. So you need to get us a thing by July 6th. So you need to get your questions to us by July 6th. We will have a link to, what was the online? Oh, here it is. online-voice-recorder.com. Basically, if you don't have any other way to record a voice, use that, download it, send it to us, or send us a link to it on Dropbox or Drive or whatever.
Oh, it'll be a small file anyway. It'll be tiny.
Yeah, if we come up with something better, it would be, we'll tell you about it in the future. But yeah, if you're interested in asking us a question, we'd love to try and answer it on air. There will be, if you are in the US time zone, we can maybe, let us know if you're interested in maybe if the timing syncs up, we'll maybe have one or two live calls on here, but probably not.
That's kind of tricky.
But yeah, the easiest way to do it, of course, is to send us a voice question. So I'll have links about it. I'll have details in the show notes.
How many people can you have join a Zencaster thing? How many channels?
I had five so far.
Five. Okay. All right.
So we could maybe do that.
Yep. So we could have several people join. We could have multiple people join, and then we could mute them until we're ready to ask a question, can't we?
That's right. Yep. And they would be able to hear everything. But
they would be able to hear the show live. Yeah.
Yeah. And, just like the real radio, Dave. It's like the real radio.
Woo. Woo.
Yeah.
Yep.
1960s technology. Here we come.
Yep. But you've got to have real buttons. You've got to have like buttons on a desk.
Yeah.
All this mouse rubbish. You know.
Next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
You're talking to Dr. Phil. Yep.
Click and clack might have been a little bit more, fun and nerdy, but yeah. I don't even think Click and Clack actually did it live, so whatever.
So tell us about your problems with your oscilloscope and how it relates to your mother. And your childhood trauma,
The Amp Hour after dark.
Oh, boy. Anyway, our Amp Hour's up, dude.
It totally
is. Let's get out of here.
Okay.
Catch you next time.